You're listening to The Fifth Estate from the Wheeler Centre. In this episode, recorded in Melbourne on Tuesday the 1st of May 2018, host Sally Warhaft is joined by American journalist Katie Turr.
Katie, of course, is an award-winning NBC news correspondent who covered Trump's entire election campaign from day one. She travelled to 40 states and made more than 3,800 reports. Trump famously singled her out for special attention and encouraged his supporters to as well. And she's put it all into a wonderful account, her experience, and her book is called Unbelievable, My Front Row Seat to the Craziest Campaign in American History. Give her another big welcome.
Thank you.
I want to start, Katie, we'll probably get into fantasy land a bit in the course of this conversation, but let's go right into it. And if we could pretend that none of us in this room had ever heard of Donald Trump and he was just a businessman that you happened to meet, describe him to us.
He's the sort of person that changes the air when he walks into a room. There's a ripple. He's got a larger-than-life quality to him, partially because he just looks like a cartoon character, with that, you know, shock of blonde hair and the extra long ties and that duck face pout that he does, and the, you know, the gestures. But he also can be, much like other successful politicians, exceedingly charming and magnanimous and the type of person that you enjoy talking to. Who's entertaining, who might not ask you a single question about yourself, but will be entertaining to listen to him talk about himself. He's bigger than life.
Would he be charismatic if he wasn't Donald Trump, if he was not president, if he was not a billionaire?
No, I think he is all of those things because he's Donald Trump. I mean, he grew up in Queens, New York. His dad was a builder and a fairly successful one, but he had a chip on his shoulder. He wanted to cross the river into Manhattan, where all the serious big-time players were. And he felt from a young age that he was, or he should be, smarter than everybody, and he should be more successful than everybody, and he should have a more beautiful wife than everybody, and he should have fancier things than everybody. And so he fought for it. And when he didn't immediately have those things, he just told everyone he did. He's a living embodiment of that cliche: if you say something enough times, people will start to believe it. He would create a razzle-dazzle around himself. And so he is bigger than life, and he is now the president of the United States because he has created this character.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting you say that about the chip on the shoulder, because I often feel like that's how he still behaves.
Oh, 100%. Mm. I mean, he felt when he went into Manhattan and started building, he felt like he wasn't being accepted by the established rich people in Manhattan. I mean, he was a millionaire, but he wasn't a classy millionaire. So he became more and more ostentatious. He needed more and more attention. And that was partially because he wanted to be accepted into this club. There's a reason why he can't let go of the New York Times. Well, he'll call, you know, a New York Times reporter that he'll trash one moment later. It's because it's the New York Times. And if the New York Times is talking to you, that means you've made it. Same thing goes for NBC News. Part of the reason why I think he latched himself onto me during the campaign, alternating between praising me and trashing me, was because it's NBC News. Mm-hmm. And if NBC News is paying attention to you, that means you are important. It's this chip on his shoulder where he wants to be accepted by what he considers to be the elite.
The very first time you met him, you sat down for an interview with him at Trump Tower.
That was the second time.
It was the second time, was it?
Yeah.
Well, tell us about the first time.
The first time. So I am suddenly thrust on this campaign. I at the time was technically living in London. I was just visiting New York for a couple days to remind my bosses that I existed. And I mean, I left milk in my fridge. I had clothes in my dryer. I was about to go on a week-long vacation with my French boyfriend in Sicily. And this was just a very short detour. And suddenly Donald Trump announced he was running for president. And for some reason, they decided to put me on it. I was just standing around the newsroom. And then I was on the Donald Trump campaign with my clothes in the dryer and my milk still in the fridge and my vacation now canceled. And the first assignment I had to be in the same space as him was to drive up to New Hampshire and go to one of his first rallies. And it's this very small rally, not like the ones you became used to seeing on television. This was a couple hundred people, maybe a little bit less, around a backyard pool in the rain, a private house. And he's rambling, talking about the wall and talking about how Mexico's sending criminals over and how he gets more standing ovations than anybody else does. And, oh, the media is terrible. And I'm looking at my phone. I'm tweeting what he's saying because I don't really know what else to do at that point because no one was taking him seriously. And he calls me out. Katie Turr, you haven't even looked up at me once. I had never met him before. There was no reason that I could think of that he would even know my name unless he, I guess, was paying attention to my other reporting over the years. But we had no relationship. But he immediately singled me out because I was from NBC News. And NBC News had sent a correspondent to cover his campaign, which imparted on him a certain amount of legitimacy.
And then when you actually sit down with him for a one-on-one, a really weird thing happens. And I couldn't stop thinking about this throughout the book, where at the end he asks you, you know, he says, you want a photo, don't you? He wants to get a photo of him with you, but for you, as if you're a fan rather than a journalist.
So this is a man who was more of a, reality show celebrity than he was a politician. And he was, you know, he's used to people, or at least he seems to be used to people wanting to take photos with him. He's Donald Trump. He was the host of The Apprentice. He owns a big glossy tower in New York. Again, bigger than life cartoon character. Donald Trump, let's take a picture with him. And this is a different version. This is Donald Trump, the politician, but he doesn't know where that line is. So he walked into this interview that I was doing with him, which was a couple days after that backyard pool event. And the first thing he says is, Katie, don't you want a picture with me? And I remember thinking, no, I don't. But I don't know how to say no. And so I take a picture with him and it's a very awkward photo where like I'm kind of half smiling and sort of grimacing because, you know, this is a candidate that I'm covering. I'm not a fan.
Well, it's a really strange thing for him to ask. And it stayed with me because I kept thinking, was that a sort of remarkable naivety on his part? Was it a tactic? You know, what was it what did that tell you about his relationship with journalists and journalism, which is what this book is all about, really?
I feel like you have some answers in the crowd.
It was followed very, very carefully in Melbourne, Australia.
So yeah. I think I don't know if it was a strategy or if it was just ego.
Mm-hmm.
I think mostly probably ego. I don't know if he was as tactful as thinking that this was a way to get nicer coverage, although it could have been. I mean, he probably sized me up and thought, 5'3", young, not a political reporter, I can, you know, charm my way through this interview. And he sat down and we started the interview and the first thing he said to me was, you know, my whole life has been a win, don't you? Which is another really weird thing to say. I don't think I've ever met a human being who said those words before and said them not ironically, like seriously. I really believe my whole life has been a win. And I again, I just smile and I said, okay. And we started the interview and it was not going to be a easy interview. It's not going to be a entertainment interview that he might have been used to from NBC because he was not a politician. This was going to be a tough interview for a man who's running for president of the United States, who's just said that one of our closest allies, or our closest ally in terms of proximity, Mexico, other than Canada, is sending criminals and rapists over the border. He just said that. I mean, I'm going to press him on it. I'm going to talk to him about stats that show that border towns don't have higher crime than interior towns. I'm going to talk to him about how people who cross the border commit less crime than people who were born here. And I'm going to confront him on it. And I'm also going to confront him on, or at least get his temperature on, a number of Republican platform issues, standard Republican policies. Where does he stand on that? Second Amendment and guns. I asked him if he owned a gun. And he got very angry about it. How dare you ask me that? Well, I mean, Republicans are very into the Second Amendment. It's a pretty standard question. He just did not like that I was not rolling over for him or taking him or buying into his charm. And so he got very angry. And the interview was extremely contentious.
And, of course, that just set up what would then become all these hundreds of days for you of sometimes appalling and incredibly public, attempts at humiliation.
510 days is how long I was on the road, not that anyone's counting. It was more of a roller coaster than that because there were long stretches where I was the only reporter that he recognized in a room before the other networks started sending their own full-time correspondents to cover him, because despite the fact that he was getting 20,000 people to come to a rally in Mobile, Alabama, 6 months before anybody started voting, people were slow to accept the reality that Donald Trump was capturing something and that he was being supported by a solid and significant portion of the Republican Party. And even though that interview that we did at first was contentious, and even though he was very angry about it, and I write about all about it in the book because it's wild, and at the end of it he says, screams at me, "You'll never be president." It's a great story. You're going to have to read it.
Of which you withheld the response, thank God, neither will you.
I did. I bit my tongue. You're going to have to read it. And after that, he still wanted to charm me. He still wanted to get the favorable coverage. So he would alternate between calling me out and getting angry about my reporting or being very friendly and trying to introduce me to a crowd as a great reporter, almost like I'm his wife or something. Mm. And I remember having to spin away from him and say, "This is really weird, and I'm going to go over here." Or kissing me on the cheek when he walked into a town hall. And then bragging about it on television, further delegitimizing my standing as a political reporter. It was just back and forth like that throughout much of the campaign. He felt like he had a more familiar relationship with me than just somebody who was assigned to follow his candidacy.
You describe one really large rally where he was being nasty, Donald, and there are journalists tweeting manically, in your defense. Your mother is ringing you continually on your mobile phone, and you end up speaking to her and she's crying and thinks that you need security, and you end up with security. So this is a, there are times in the book where there was one, where you're walking back through a car park with the supporters who he has egged on to have a go at you, it felt like you felt your personal safety was threatened at times. Is that a fair reading?
I will say that I can't think of, and I don't think this is ever happened before, where a political reporter would need armed security to cover a candidate in America. it's just not the way things have ever worked before until this election. And it wasn't just me. I mean, all of the reporters covering Donald Trump were eventually assigned by their networks, for the most part, former Secret Service agents who were armed, to stand guard over them whenever they were outside of a rally in all parts of the country, or if they were outside of Trump Tower in Manhattan. The only ones who didn't have it were Fox News. But which is a bit wild, because the Fox News reporter was not easy on him. I mean, the channel gets a bad rap, and just in general, for its skewed coverage. But the reporter they had covering Fox is this veteran campaign reporter, and he was really tough. But that's beside the point. And then there was a CBS reporter named Major who didn't have armed security, but his name is Major, and he is very major looking as well. No, I mean, it was sad. Yeah, it was scary, but more than anything else, it was sad that we had come to a point where our lives were being threatened. And not because it was just some crazy person who was angry about the way we were covering him, but because the president himself, or the candidate himself, was standing on a stage and pointing me out in a crowd and saying, "Little Katie, she's a liar, she's back there. What a lie." And the entire, you know, rally of thousands of people would turn around and scream at me. I mean, that's...
There was something about your mum's calls too that, you know, she's a serious journalist. Both your parents, in fact, together started a whole news service. They were the first people in LA, possibly in America, they bought a helicopter and became the first journalist to realise you could fly in a helicopter to cover stories, and did some absolutely. They're involved in the O.J. Simpson.
They found O.J. in the slow speed pursuit in Los Angeles, and they covered the L.A. riots. I'm not sure if you guys remember that, but the man who got pulled out of the red gravel truck and beaten up on live television, a brick was thrown at his head. My mom was hanging out of the helicopter, literally hanging out of the helicopter, strapped in with a canvas belt and a Betacam on her shoulder, filming it as these gang members were shooting at the helicopter.
So this is not any mother, right?
This is one tough broad, let me tell
crying
you.
Crying on the phone for a daughter saying this isn't safe.
I mean, my parents got death threats for that for that coverage, because they ended up testifying against those gang members. They were used to it. I mean, putting your life on the line for journalism was just something you did in my household. But this, my mom is still my mom. And it is still extremely scary when your daughter, as tough as she might be, is in a room surrounded on all sides by very angry people who are being whipped up by a candidate who seems to have no regard for anyone's safety.
This was your first political campaign. But you were obviously working with other people that covered lots of them. There must have been some benefits for you going in with not really knowing how it is meant to work. What did your colleagues tell you? What were you thinking in trying to untangle which bit of this is the great American electoral circus show and which bit of it is the Trump freak show?
Well, I mean, that was the most difficult part. The blessing that I had was that I didn't have the baggage of living in Washington or being a political journalist, so I could look at this entire campaign with fresh eyes. I could assess it without bias when I would see thousands of people show up for a rally and wait outside in 100-degree temperatures in Phoenix, Arizona, or -5 degrees in Des Moines, Iowa, and just wait there until Donald Trump would show up hours at a time. A lot of that was written off by the more established reporters as just kind of a sideshow. And these were the unserious people, or they were the people that were just out to see a show. When people got to the ballot box, they would never cast a vote for Donald Trump. They would get serious. I mean, there was just a litany of excuses being made. First, it was the summertime, and nobody takes politics seriously in the, you know, summer a year and a half before an election. Then it was, once the fall comes around, football will be back on television and people will be paying attention to that more than a Donald Trump rally. And then, oh wait, no, Homeland will be back on TV and they'll be watching that instead. Or the holidays will be here and they'll get serious. And oh no, the votes start in, you know, in early February. That's when Donald Trump won't be a thing any longer. But during that entire time, the rallies only got bigger and bigger. He only said more and more outrageous things, and his poll numbers kept getting stronger and stronger. So the established thinking, or the presumptions of the political class and of reporters, didn't match up with the reality of what we were seeing on the ground. Obviously, as a newbie political reporter, I questioned my judgment. I didn't know that if I thought maybe I had Stockholm syndrome. just maybe I had no idea what the greater reality was, but something was nagging at me the whole time. And I ended up sounding on our morning news conference calls with the entire company, where you pitch your story for the day or you give an assessment of what you have for the news. I don't know if The Simpsons is a big deal in Australia. Mm. I presume it is. There's a meme, old man yells at cloud. That's what I sounded like on those calls, because I would say, no, guys, this is happening. Mm. People are, they don't care that he wants to ban all Muslims from coming into the U.S. Not just that, they like it. Mm. They don't care that he's bragging about grabbing women by the genitals. They're fine with it. They don't care that he's going after a Mexican-American judge or a judge of Mexican heritage and saying he's not fair because of his family background. They don't care that he's fighting with the Pope. They're fine with all of it because they think he just tells it like it is, or they really hate Hillary Clinton, or they just really hate the rest of us, hate all the media, hate everyone in Washington, and want to send us a big gift-wrapped middle finger in the form of Donald Trump.
There was at some point, and perhaps you'd be able to tell us when that might have been, a kind of numbness that set in to his extravagances, I felt, where there were so many stories covered so intensely and they just sort of kept coming day after day after day that it almost, they weren't being treated.
It flattened out.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, that's true. And that's what made him so difficult to cover. I mean, he would bury one controversy with the next controversy. And what we struggled with and what we still struggle with is, how do you maintain a focus on a very important story like him going after a Mexican-American judge when the next day he's, you know, I can't remember what happened the very next day now. But when the next day he's, you know, going after Alicia Machado and saying that she had a sex tape, and you know, going after women or calling Hillary Clinton not fit enough or not that she didn't have the presidential look. I mean, everything he would say was important in the sense that this was a man who was running on the GOP platform, major party, gathering support. Saying things that you generally have not been allowed to say before, crossing lines that nobody would dare ever cross, trashing normal political decency, just behaving in a way that most people wouldn't let their four-year-old behave. And so it was hard to keep up with it. And at the same time, he had no policy whatsoever. Mm. There was just nothing there. And so you'd have to try and press him on that. And what it did was it made it really difficult for the other candidates to run against him, because they couldn't get a word in edgewise. And when the general election came around, Hillary Clinton was so befuddled by how to run against him that she ended up just fighting back instead of presenting her own policy. So policy really got the short shrift in our coverage. So nobody was really talking about what these people were going to do when they got into office, other than the broad strokes of he's going to build a wall and et cetera. It was all it was like being in a cafeteria in high school, a food fight.
The most sensational example of that for me was the Hollywood Access tapes, the vile tapes. And when I reread, you know, the words on the page in your book of what he said in those tapes about women, I just I have called him the vulgarian at the Fifth Estate ever since. I very rarely talk about him by name. I can barely say it. And I always felt that that just made him illegitimate, even though there are now people who want to give him a Nobel Peace Prize for Korea, which we'll get to. But that tape came out. He made the first and only apology he's ever made, a taped sort of YouTube thing. But at the end of it, of course, there's the Trump dig about Hillary, and I've got something more coming. And I think it was the very next night, or a couple of nights later, was the second debate. And there's Republican people disowning him at a rate of knots. And you bump into his chief of staff, who basically just says, you know, just you wait.
Yeah, this was Steve Bannon, his chief strategist. And so the Access Hollywood tape comes out on a Friday around 4 o'clock. I go on air and try to describe the things that he says on that tape, describe the indescribable. And by midnight that night, as people are calling for his head, he tapes this apology that reads more like a hostage video than anything else, turns the tables and says, oh, no, but Bill Clinton has done so much worse. What I said is just words. What Bill Clinton has done is terrible.
And what Hillary
And what Hillary did to enable him and to help cover it up. So that was a Friday. Saturday, the campaign goes dark. Kellyanne Conway cancels all of her television appearances, which is a really big deal because she would go to any camera that would have her on at the time. We couldn't get a comment from the campaign. I think more than a dozen or 50-plus Republicans, either current lawmakers or former lawmakers, were saying that they weren't going to vote for him or that he should drop out of the race. They could never vote for somebody who said that about women. They couldn't look at their wives and say, I'm going to vote for this man. Suddenly, every Republican realized that they knew a woman. And they were horrified by it. In no uncertain terms, I will never vote for this man, many said. I could never support him. The day after that, Sunday, was the second Republican debate, as you said. And I run into Steve Bannon as they are leaving Trump Tower to go to St. Louis. And he comes out the elevators, and I say, Steve. And he barely stops. And I ask, you know, what are you going to do at the debate? What's your strategy? And he gives me kind of a coy look. And then I ask something along the lines of, are you going to go after Bill Clinton? It seems that way from what Donald Trump said in that tape. And he said, you know, just wait and see. He smiles. We get to St. Louis. There's the campaign announces that they're going to have a little press conference before the debate starts. A bunch of reporters file into this room in a local hotel, and out come all of the women who had accused Bill Clinton of rape or worse. Paula Jones, and a couple others. And the reporters in the room, I wasn't in there because I was filing for something else, but I saw it because it was all live fed. Their jaws dropped to the floor. I mean, it was, we thought, yes, it could happen, but nobody thought it would actually happen. And they came out and this was the grand intention to drag Clinton down in the mud with him. Whatever you throw at me, I'm going to throw back at you. I'm rubber and you're glue. That was his strategy. And the debate started, and they tried to get the accusers to sit in the family boxes so the accusers would have to face Bill Clinton as everyone sat down. And that set the tone for, wasn't successful. They ended up sitting up a little bit higher. But it set the tone for that debate. And it was fiery. Donald Trump was angry. He was breathing really hard. You could hear it, that sniff that he does when he's really nervous.
And the next day, the stools, wasn't it?
Yeah, he was almost looked like he was stalking Clinton. The next day, when we went to a rally, just as crowded as ever. and nobody cared. A woman was wearing a shirt that said, "Donald Trump can grab me by my," with an arrow pointed down. They embraced it. In the same way they embraced the deplorables title. They embraced it. And the Republicans who said, "I could never vote for Donald Trump," were suddenly walking that back. Mm. "Oh my God, he's not going anywhere. What do we do? Oh, maybe it wasn't so bad."
You describe the maniacal sort of energy and life that goes into what you were doing, following, you know, you're on buses, planes, trains, eating fake food. I mean, it just sounded just really hard work. Obviously, your whole life before was just left behind. What were you hearing about Camp Hillary? What was going on over there?
So I didn't cover Hillary Clinton. I mean, I was siloed. I covered Donald Trump.
But you must have talked to people and heard.
Here's what I know from at the time. Hillary Clinton was not getting the same amount of enthusiasm from potential voters as Donald Trump was. Mm. It just, her rallies were much smaller, not because she wanted them to be much smaller, just because people were not showing up. Donald Trump was absolutely correct when he said, "I get on stage, just me alone, and I get more people than Hillary Clinton does when she has a rock star come out and perform for her, open for her." She would have like Katy Perry or Jay-Z and Beyonce, and still Donald Trump alone without a guitar was getting more people to come out and support him. So there was a very big enthusiasm gap, and I was able to talk to a lot of voters. Just, I mean, what you do in these circumstances is, yes, you talk to people that go to the rallies, but then you try to talk to everybody else. You go to the diners and you ask people in the diner what they think. You get on the airplane, you ask the person sitting next to you what they think. My big litmus test was, or I don't know if that's the right way to describe it, but my big temperature taker was asking cab drivers what they thought, cab drivers all around the country. And almost without fail, didn't matter where I was or if the cab driver was a woman or a minority or a white guy, most liked Donald Trump. Mm. Talking to a woman, and I believe it was North Carolina, and she just, this was after the Access Hollywood tape, and she just loved him. She, "Oh, it's locker room talk. Everyone talks like that. No big deal." Talking to a Sikh guy, "Well, I think he's great. And yes, we should keep those immigrants out." So it wasn't, I mean, it wasn't as simple as Donald Trump's only appealing to white men.
Mm. Oh, well, it was women that got him in.
White women, yeah. Mm.
What do you think, if anything, with hindsight, if you were in charge of the whole media universe in the United States?
If I was president, you mean?
Yeah, something like that. A president of the media. What could have, could things have been done differently?
They could have been done better. Mm. That's the beautiful thing about life, is you move forward and you can look back and you can say, here's where I could have been a little bit better. I think what we did not do is we didn't cover the voters enough. We got a little too mired in the horse race of it and the outrageous things that Donald Trump said. I think next time for 2020, what we need to be doing is talking to voters about what they care about, the issues that they are facing in their communities, and how that can affect an election on a much broader scale. Australia is a very big country. America is a very big country. There's a lot of dissenting views. It's a very difficult place to govern cohesively with just two parties, because those two parties don't do a particularly adequate job of representing everybody. But we need to find a way to figure out what matters to them and apply that to the appeal for whatever candidate we're covering, and rather than the other way around.
At the Fifth Estate about 6 or 8 weeks ago, and you can see this interview on the podcast, I had Pat Kinane here, who was he was the media monitor for Obama for 6.5 years. So he started in the White House when he was 24, and he wrote a book about what it was like to be, he moved up through the ranks, and because of his special place in the White House, he was never more than about 20 feet away from the Oval Office and got to know Obama quite well. And he writes in his book, as your book is all of it is a lead up to election night and Trump coming out on stage, and in a way his is as well. But he describes being in the Rose Garden at 2:30 in the morning with an awful glass cup, paper cup of red wine on his own, lying down in the Rose Garden, just looking at the sky in tears, and then bursting into tears the next day in front of Obama as Obama says, "Don't worry, the world's not going to end." And throughout the whole book, it's just absolutely clear they just did not see it coming. You know, they referred to Hillary the whole year as the president in waiting.
Yeah. And I know a lot of Clinton officials now that I didn't know during the campaign, and I've talked to them about where they think it went wrong. And the feeling is they didn't, you know, it's a general feeling that we've all heard. They didn't appeal to working class voters. They didn't offer an idea of their own. What they did was they went after Trump, and that was it. Their candidacy was based more on being anti-Trump than it was on being pro-Hillary Clinton, and they didn't go to Michigan, which is one of the big criticisms. Obviously, they believe that a number of things could have affected them beyond that, including potential Russian interference. It's hard to establish, at least at the moment, the causal relationship between the two. But the Comey emails as well, that was certainly a big factor. But the presumption was, I think, for most people in Washington or the big cities, those that presumed Hillary Clinton would win, was that everybody thought the way they did. Well, I think I think Donald Trump is a terrible candidate, and he's belligerent, and he has no idea what he's talking about, and he's completely unfit to lead. So everybody else thinks that way as well. They obviously will see what I see, which is that this should never happen. But that wasn't the case, and it was almost this willful ignorance about what the rest of the country was feeling and had been feeling for the past 8 years. A lot of folks who voted for Obama voted for Donald Trump. A lot of folks who wanted Bernie Sanders ended up voting for Donald Trump. They are people who felt like the economy was moving past them, and they wanted someone to pay attention. Hey, no, we haven't forgotten about you. We're going to lift you up too. They felt that it was, instead of going to them, going to the cities and going to people in a more preferential state than they were in. And Donald Trump was somebody who, while very imperfect, and many of the voters that voted for him didn't like him, they felt, well, why not take a chance on something completely different? We keep voting politicians in and nothing seems to change. Why not try something completely absurd? Because maybe that'll be the thing that shakes Washington into action. I mean, we had 8 years of almost nothing getting done because everything the Democrats or Obama tried to propose, the Republicans blocked. There was no working together. Mm. Congress was very broken. And the thought was, among some of the voters, well, Donald Trump's not an ideologue. And he was a Democrat. So maybe he can reach across the aisle in a way that a more traditional Republican like Marco Rubio or Ted Cruz cannot, or a more traditional Democrat like Hillary Clinton cannot.
And it's interesting, these two accounts, the more I think about it, are really illustrative of what happened, because I think in your book, I don't even recall the word Washington in it. You're out there. He's just out there everywhere but Washington. And in this other book I referred to, it's just Washington. There was nowhere else at all.
It's a real bubble. Mm. It's just.
And Trump made hay out of that, didn't he?
But he was absolutely right about it, and he still is. Mm. There's a reason why I didn't go to Washington. I mean, there's a number of reasons. But one of the big ones was I want to maintain that outsider quality. That groupthink you get living in that city, I think, makes it very difficult to approach covering another election in a unbiased way.
You were obviously offered the Washington gig, as is the right of the...
I took myself out of contention before we even got to that stage.
Interesting decision. And completely understand it. I mean, I can't even believe you were willing to relive the whole thing to write this book, Katie. So,
Neither can I.
Tell us, and now you're talking about it. Tell us, given what you know of him and observed in the campaign... and now into his presidency this far, is he doing, is he tracking along about how you would have expected, or is it worse or perhaps a bit better than you might have anticipated given what you've seen?
It is about what I did expect. I thought there was a real possibility that he could have started things differently and it would have gone on another track. Say he went into office and said we're going to do infrastructure before we try to repeal Obamacare. That would have changed the dynamic between Donald Trump and the Democrats and Republicans, and it potentially could have got him on a much more magnanimous road. But Donald Trump never revealed himself to be anything close to magnanimous during the campaign. Anyone who thought that suddenly he was going to put on his top hat, his presidential hat, and be different than he was, I think was deluding themselves. Or maybe they were just being very hopeful. Mm. Donald Trump is who he is. He is a 72-year-old man who has behaved a certain way his entire life. Nothing has changed. He's always been belligerent. He's always lied to get to his, as a means to his ends. He's not somebody who likes compromise. He may say that he is the author of the art of the deal and nobody makes better deals than he does, but that's not true. That's just a tagline. So it's tracked much as I expected it to. I can say, though, as an American citizen, I am still unnerved by how far and how low he is willing to go to tear down institutions in order to try and defend himself or inflate his ego.
And do you think they'll be able to be put back together?
I don't know.
Mm.
I think it's hard to put toothpaste back in the bottle.
Mm. Is he doing anything well? From your point of view, what's he...
Well, listen, I think that if you are a Donald Trump voter and you voted for him because you wanted conservative judges, you're really happy with Donald Trump right now. Conservative judges have been installed. They appointed Judge Gorsuch to the Supreme Court. That is a major win for conservative voters. I think that if you are a working class voter who voted for him because you want to see jobs grow, you're going to say, hey, I like the tariffs. And some Democrats will say, I like the tariffs as well. That's something that has broader appeal than just the Republicans. Or I'm really happy with the deregulation that's happened. Or I think the tax bill is going to put some more money in my wallet. There are things that you can vote to if you are a supporter of Donald Trump and say, hey, listen, this isn't being covered and this is making me very, very happy. It just depends on what side you're on and how you decide to look at it.
Mm. If you'd like to ask Katie a question, just put your hand up and wait for a microphone.
Could you raise any issues about his tax returns? Did he actually go bankrupt sort of in the 90s?
And, he did.
And so how did he get another million, billion?
I'm not going to pretend to be a financial expert, but he did go bankrupt. His business went bankrupt a few times in the 90s, four or five times. He was on the verge of financial collapse again. And what he did was he, as Jimmy Breslin wrote about it in the 90s, he created a razzle-dazzle. He would call all of the business reporters in town and say, Donald Trump will never fail. Donald Trump is bigger and greater than everybody. And they bought into it. And then what stemmed from that was other banks still taking chances on him, and he basically leveraged all of his debt to his advantage. Or he would, when you file bankruptcy in America, it gives you a lot of leeway to just kind of start over fresh without the baggage of that debt.
We don't have that here.
Yeah, and
we punish people forever, really. For
there's a way that he he used his tax returns, the ones that we haven't seen anything but like a two-page return from, I believe it was 1995. And we don't know this definitively because we haven't seen more of the returns. But what it did show was that he could have potentially used a loophole in the tax system that would allow him to write off a certain amount of millions and millions of dollars in losses that he could then extend over years and years. So he would not have to pay any taxes for years and years. It's a complicated explanation. We don't know more about it because we haven't seen more of his tax returns. He refuses to release them. The White House still maintains that he's under audit, but nobody has given us a shred of evidence to prove that he actually is. And the thing is, in America, you just don't need to, if you don't want to release him, you don't have to.
Hi. I was just wondering how you hold the Trump administration to account when we seem to live in an era where media access is so polarized on party lines, and we're in a post-truth era where facts no longer have the power they used to.
It's a difficult question, and that's the first line in my book. I'm about to throw up. It's election night. Donald Trump has won, is about to win, and I've said I'm about to throw up. I was about to throw up, not because Donald Trump won, or because he's a Republican, or because I wanted a Democrat, or vice versa, I wanted a Republican, another Republican, but because he had been campaigning against facts in this post-fact, post-truth landscape where he could say, I love the beautiful turquoise chaise lounge you're sitting on right now, Katie. And I could say, no, it's an orange chair. And he would say, no, it's a beautiful turquoise chaise lounge. And no, it's not. It's maddening. It's hard to report on it when some people refuse to accept established reality, or when they say that facts aren't facts because they don't like them. I had somebody tweet me once, who are you to decide the facts? We decide the facts. No, facts are stubborn. Facts are facts.
You suggest too that all American students now, young, should have lessons in journalism.
I mean, if you really want to guard against the destruction of our democratic process and our system, we need to understand how journalism works from a young age. We need to understand how knowledge is passed on, how information is gathered, how it is vetted. We don't have that. People don't understand journalism now. There's this presumption because what we've seen for the past 30, 40 years is politicians trying to tear the mainstream media down, is that we are all a bunch of liberal hacks. And you can't believe what we're saying because it goes against the candidate that you like. The problem with that is that when you do it for so long, you've eaten away at all the credibility that the media has. So when you need us to push back, when you need us to contextualize, when you need us to be the catcher in the rye, we don't have that authority any longer. And that's a really dangerous world that we're living in. Sure, there are politicians who will tell you the truth, but most politicians spin. They might not lie, but they will spin. And without the media there to put it into perspective, to correct it, it's just propaganda. That's what you have in authoritarian states. That's what you have in Russia. It's not what you should have in America. And the only way you work with that now is you try to continue doing your job in the best way possible and as responsibly as you can. You don't get two sources any longer for a story. You get 3, 4, 5, 6, or 12. You get even more stringent in the way that you report.
Hi. Now that you look back over that campaign, do you see any, with perspective, the timing of the release of the Podesta emails so close in timing to the Access Hollywood tape, and other odd coincidences, the things that happen on Facebook and other things? Do you look back now and say, and see it any differently?
You know, there was a news conference July 27th, 2016. Donald Trump held in the middle of the Democratic National Convention. And he says, and I'm at this news conference, he says, Russia, if you're listening, I hope you find Hillary Clinton's 30,000 emails. And I raise my hand and I say, does that not give you pause? asking a foreign country to hack into an email of a private citizen or a politician in this country. No, it gives me no pause. It was a very odd statement at the time. It got a lot of coverage. It was very weird. We know now that's when the FBI really started looking into, and the intelligence community really started looking into the campaign, because it didn't make sense to them either. It seemed like a wild statement. In late August, you had Roger Stone, who was this unofficial longtime friend of Donald Trump, tweet about John Podesta's, it's his turn in the barrel. Okay, what does that mean? Who knows? October 7th, Donald Trump, the Access Hollywood tape comes out at 3:30. I think a couple hours later, John Podesta's first emails drop. And every day from that day until Election Day, there is a new batch of John Podesta emails. And then on Election Day, they stop. I don't know if that's all one big coincidence. I am not privy to all of the information that Robert Mueller's team has. But it certainly looks suspicious. And it certainly, according to the legal experts and the former federal investigators that I talked to, it certainly is enough to raise flags and to open an investigation, which is exactly what's going on right now.
Thank you. This has been incredibly interesting. But my question is, 4 more years or whatever it might be?
It would be 6.
Six more years.
If he wins again.
Yeah.
Maybe, I don't know. Could he win again? Yes. The stuff that got him elected in 2016 is still out there. And again, voters who like him could point to all the things I just mentioned a moment ago. But his margin of victory was so, so small in just three different counties. So if those independent voters decide that they didn't like him as much as they did in 2016, or the gamble that they took didn't pay off, or if Democratic voters are more enthusiastic about the next Democratic candidate, or if there's a larger turnout for voting than there was in 2016, things could change pretty rapidly. You guys have compulsory voting here, which is amazing. We don't have that in the States. I don't understand why we don't, because that would change everything about our democratic process. Right now, a paltry number of people vote in our elections, which means that a paltry number of people are actually represented by our government. If that changed, say they moved voting day from a Tuesday, middle of the day, to, I don't know, a Saturday, or made it a week-long event, things would really change. I don't see that happening anytime soon, because there's all sorts of interests out there that wouldn't want it to. But yeah, there is. He doesn't have a lot of room for error. He could win again, but he could also lose by a landslide. We just don't know
the
yet.
The Democrats are going to have to get it together, though. Is there anybody that's looking the goods?
I have no idea. I ask every Democratic lawmaker or strategist that I have on my show, who's the leader of the Democratic Party? Never get an answer. Mm. I was having a conversation on background with a fairly prominent lawmaker, and I asked them in the Democratic Party who they thought should run, and they looked at me and they said, I just don't know who we have. But that being said, it's hard to predict these things as far out as now. Remember, Donald Trump wasn't somebody that the Republicans thought could win. They looked like they were in the wilderness up before the 2016 election. We have a long history of just of crazy people suddenly making a run at the last minute. Barack Obama wasn't a favorite by anyone's standards early on. There was a lot of talk about him, but certainly not someone most people thought could get elected as early as he did.
Poor Hillary. When you go back to Obama's first nomination, I just wonder what she thinks every night when her head hits the pillow about the future that sort of wasn't.
Wouldn't you say that the media was pretty culpable in the creation of Donald Trump as a phenomenon?
No.
You know, he's great copy and the camera loves him.
No.
And you talked about, like, one drama eclipsing the next drama. You guys are all running to the next drama and leaving the old one behind. Like, you guys have played a huge role in creating him as a superstar.
No, that's not true. We did not. Donald Trump was, I mean, he had certainly a lot of name recognition because He was a reality show star, but I don't think that that's the media's fault that he was popular on reality television. He was popular on reality TV. He built this mythology around himself as this great business leader. We covered him because he gained traction. We initially covered him as an absurdity, an oddity. He was a joke. Nobody thought he was going to be a serious contender. We started covering him more because he was a serious contender, because 20,000 people showed up in Mobile, Alabama for a man who's been divorced twice, has had three wives, brags about affairs, and swears and has no real palpable or demonstrable relationship to religion. I mean, but regardless of that, didn't serve in the military. 20,000 people showed up in Mobile, Alabama to go see him. That was not because we were airing his rallies live. That's because they liked him. We aired his rallies because he said news-making things all the time. We covered him like we cover a hurricane, or we cover a baby panda's birth. That's what we cover. We cover the news, and Donald Trump was the news. We were not nice to him in our coverage. So if you were looking at it and saying, God, the media created him, what did we create? We created somebody that we mostly reported wasn't qualified or fit to be president of the United States. I didn't hold a gun to anyone's head and say, you need to vote for Donald Trump or not vote for Donald Trump. That's completely in the American voters' hands. That's like saying Donald Trump happened to the American voter instead of the American voter voting for Donald Trump. And I give the American voter a little bit more credit than that. So I just think it's an incredibly easy thing to do, to blame the media for something you don't like. I just don't think it's true.
He was already a massive media creation of a different kind, wasn't he, through reality television.
He was but that's like saying, I don't know, did we create Oprah Winfrey if she gets elected? No, she was already a popular person. I mean, he had the benefit of 100% name recognition. Mm. What he did so successfully with The Apprentice was he made people believe that he was smart. Mm. And that he knew how to hire the best people.
Absolutely fascinating, thank you. I'm a former journalist, and I'm deeply alarmed by the stories that you were talking about with the mob mentality, being in the middle, doing your job, and being frightened by what's going on and wondering whether people are going to do violence to you. So two things in relation to that. One is, did NBC consider taking you off? Did you ever ask perhaps that it was just too much? Or two, on another personal level, I mean, post-traumatic stress disorder, I don't want to go into it in a detail, but I mean, that was really traumatic stuff. You know, was there a consequence of doing your job, and how did your employer look after you?
Yeah, NBC would have loved it, wouldn't they? You getting all that attention?
Well, I'm not sure. You're a journalist. Would you have been asked to be taken off the Trump campaign? You would have left? I wouldn't have. I didn't want to. I was nervous about my safety. But I'm a reporter who wanted to cover wars. I was a foreign correspondent to start doing that. I didn't get that chance because I ended up having to cover the Trump campaign. I think that regardless of what was happening to me personally, it was and still is a fascinating moment in American history. And I want to be up close to that. I want to understand it. That's why I got into this business, because I want to make sense of things that don't seem to make any sense. So no, I never asked to be taken off of it. And NBC knew that. I mean, if I had said I want to go, they would have let me go. But I think they understood that I didn't want to go. What we did to make sure that I was safe and my other reporters or my other colleagues were safe.
It's an all-female team for the first time in history.
We had security. Mm. We had armed security with us. So that certainly helped. Anytime that I was feeling uncomfortable, I had full authority to leave that situation. But I would never, ever be asked to be taken off that story. Mm. Just because, I mean, you're midway on a roller coaster. You're gonna unstrap your belt and get out. I know.
You feel it in the book all the time, this sort of, and this hunger you have to get more. You know, it's not enough just to report this crazy stuff. You've actually got to create some of your own as well.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, listen, I post-traumatic stress, I think is a real thing. And one of my friends who was on the beat as well is dealing with a lot of that. The benefit that I had in dealing with it was writing this book. I instead of just internalizing it and dwelling on it and letting it kind of eat away at my insides, writing the book was a really cathartic experience because I was able to process. Oh shoot! Able to process. Ah, I did it again. Able to process it all immediately after it happened. And luckily, you know, I met my husband while I was on the road and.
The French boyfriend didn't last.
He didn't
last,
make it.
Right?
Désolé.
Yeah.
And he has been so incredibly supportive. And whenever I've needed to talk or lose my mind, and it usually happens around 1 a.m. when he's trying to go to sleep and I just get really spun up and crazy, he's been really patient. He's listened. And it's helped me a lot.
One other thing that Pat Conane talked about was he said on that last day in the White House with Obama, he realised he was looking at a monument, that one day there were just going to be, you know, bridges and airports named after him. And now I look at Trump and I think you're going to be a monument one day. That's what you're going to be, you know, that in history forever, we just don't know what kind of monument yet it might be. We have to wind it up. It's gone so fast. The book is called Unbelievable. The story is unbelievable. And we're unbelievably grateful that you came to tell us. Thank you, Katie.
Thank you guys for having me.
Katie Turr, in conversation with Sally Warhaft, live at the Wheeler Centre in Melbourne. If you'd like to find more to listen to, or if you're looking for videos of these discussions, head over to wheelercentre.com. We'll be back in a couple of weeks with another episode. Until then, take care.